Like the show? Want to listen to episodes early? Consider becoming a patron. Starting at the $3 a month level, patrons get access to a custom patron-only feed where we put out episodes of upstairs studio podcasts like the Childcare Bar and Grill, Miss Becky's Classroom, That Early Childhood Nerd, the Renegade Rules podcast, and others early. That feed is just for patrons. You could be one of them. Go to patreon.com/playvolutionhq or click the link in the show description to learn more. Murphy.
Hello.
Tasha Johnson.
Aloha.
What's your new title? Josie, Miss Josie.
Fun Time.
Miss Josie Fun Time is with us. And on phone, we have Andrew Rozak?
Rozak.
Did I get it right, Andrew?
Yes, Rozak. You got
Rozak,
it.
I got it right. And Andrew is, he's a preparedness guy. Now, this is a topic, listeners, that we don't really get into on this podcast all that often because it's kind of outside our direct wheelhouse, but we thought it would be important, and I've kind of scoured Andrew's website, which is childhoodpreparedness.org, and it's the Institute for Child Preparedness. I like the tagline, don't be scared, be prepared. I think that sums up a kind of a lot of what we talk about in terms of early learning setting operations when it comes to play and emotional environments and that kind of stuff. And I think it makes perfect sense to talk a little bit about preparedness as we usually think about it in early learning settings, about power outages and tornadoes and fire drills and all that kind of stuff. So Andrew, tell us a little bit about yourself and then let's just jump into some conversation about general preparedness in early learning settings.
Absolutely. Well, it's really great to be here. Big fan, a longtime listener, so it's an honor to be with you guys today.
Thank you.
I started as of course, I started as a firefighter paramedic and did that for about 10 years in the Chicagoland area. And after I left the fire service, I actually went to law school, so I'm actually an attorney as well. And I've been working on emergency preparedness issues on the ground, from the policy level, from all sorts of different angles for over 20 years. I've worked in the United States Senate. I worked as a senior advisor for the federal government. And I also was a senior preparedness advisor supporting the work of Super Bowl 46 when it was in Indianapolis, Indiana.
And, so you've got some experience.
I've got some experience with this. The last 5 years of my life have been, focused solely on early childhood. And we work every day to help early childhood professionals prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies and disasters. And I think it's some of the most rewarding work I've done in my professional career, to be honest with you. So really excited to talk a little bit about what that means and so some simple, low-cost solutions on how we can make ourselves a little bit better prepared.
So right off the bat, I've got two questions. As a former firefighter, did you ever watch the television show Emergency
I love that show.
Back in the day?
Randolph Mantooth.
Yes, I was a big fan of Johnny and Roy. They had it easy because they didn't have to transport. They just showed up and, got everybody feeling better, and then they let the other folks do the hard work of transport.
Yeah, a lot of squealing around and explosions in that show, as I recall it. Josie here is too young to remember that. And then the other thing, what made you decide early learning was an adventure you were going to take?
Yeah, I was going to ask that myself, if you don't mind elaborating. What was the impetus for changing over to early childhood?
Well, it's just one of those funny things. I'm a professor over at Old Dominion University, and I'm always, the students are always saying, like, what about a career path? What about a career path? And my career path has just been, very, very different and, contrasted with my father, who spent 20 plus years as a police officer. And of course, his resume is a lot easier to fit on one piece of paper than mine is. But I'd been doing a lot of work with the public health departments. I was a senior director of emergency preparedness, catastrophic response, and pandemic preparedness and environmental health, and doing a lot of work with CDC and just the 3,100 local health departments. And, you know, public health has got that real close intersection with vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. And I kind of fell in love with that, to be honest. And if you think about a population that's vulnerable, well, really, it's the old and the young. And, you know, especially caring for those who can't care for themselves. So I had an opportunity to start working in early childhood. I actually joined an organization called Child Care Aware of America as their senior director of emergency preparedness. And that's kind of how I got started. And then it led to founding the Institute of Childhood Preparedness and all that kind of good stuff. So
great. I think my experience is that's kind of an open place in the marketplace where there was kind of a lack of training and knowledge base for programs to reach out to. So I think it's a great idea. Let's start here, Andrew. Last night we were hanging out with a early learning program owner, and we were talking that we're going to be talking with you, and we got talking about things like tornado drills and fire drills and that kind of stuff. And he honestly mentioned, and this was kind of late in the evening, and we were having a couple cocktails, and he kind of mentioned that when it came to things like fire drills, he was kind of at a weird place with them because where their program is located, it's on a busy street, and taking all those kids outside for that drill once a month to check it off the list was kind of a risk, hazard, potential danger in itself. And you know, what's the importance of those kind of things? And do we need to be doing those things every month, or are there different ways we can approach preparedness when it comes to those kind of things? Or just give us an overview here.
Yeah, so I mean, I think first off, you're 100% right that this is needed. And I don't think it's fair. You know, we've seen a lot of different requirements with, you know, the Child Care Development Block Grant and all that kind of stuff coming down. You've seen this push from the federal level at more emergency preparedness stuff. And I think that's a good thing. But I think it's not necessarily fair to folks that work in early childhood to now suddenly expect them overnight to be emergency preparedness experts. I mean, that's certainly not something that they signed up for.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, even the inspectors that go out at the state level or the county level, oftentimes what I see is they say, okay, the requirements say, do you have an emergency preparedness plan? And someone gives them a piece of paper and they look at it and they say, okay, check, you've got one.
Yeah, which just checking the boxes.
Exactly. You know, I want to move beyond that checking the box. I really want people to think because a lot of these plans, and I've had the opportunity, you know, to review hundreds of them, if not thousands of them, they're not rooted in reality. So it, you know, maybe it makes you feel good that you checked that box and satisfied this, you know, licensing requirement. But at the end of the day, I'm really worried that these plans just will never be operational. So, you know, having expertise and having people you can turn to, low-cost solutions, people with that actually understand early childhood and understand that we are beyond just babysitting. In fact, I would argue that we're probably the most crucial in a child's life if you look at the research on brain development and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, we are some of the first educators of emergency preparedness in the world. And there's a reason why when kids actually get to formal, you know, elementary school, middle school, there's a reason why the kids already know what to do in emergencies and disasters, and that is thanks to the great work that early childhood providers do every single day in preparing them through fire drills, tornado drills, coping mechanisms, you know, trying to deflect the adverse childhood experiences or events that happen, and all that work. So in many ways, the early childhood profession as a sector are really unsung heroes when it comes to preparedness. So to answer the question, you know, I guess more directly, yes, I do think it's important that we do fire drills and tornado drills. And in some cases now we're seeing requirements for, you know, active shooter and acts of violence.
Uh-huh.
I think that is important for two levels. First off, it's important to get your staff trained because we've seen horrible incidents time after time. Parkland, Florida comes to mind. Gosh, even all the way back to Sandy Hook. There are substitute teachers that simply did not know what to do during emergencies. And in this particular case, I'm talking specifically about active shooter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we got to make sure anybody that's coming into our building knows what their authority is. They know what to do, knows what our plans are to protect the young kids that we're entrusted to care for. So while, yes, I do agree it's a pain, and especially now that the cold weather is gripping the nation, it's not the best thing to go do a fire drill in the middle of January or December. But the reality is we have 560 fires in early childhood every year. Now, that's more than a fire a day. And, you know, if you're not prepared for something like that, you're going to be caught off guard. And the time to make your emergency plan is not when the building is on fire. So it is really important to have these drills, set expectations of what staff are going to do, and also start to, you know, set expectations for the children of, hey, what do we expect from you when these drills and when these real events happen?
Yeah, I think, you know, on this show and when Lisa and I are speaking at early learning events, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, controlling the environment, managing the environment so you can trust the children to play and kind of do their thing. And on the preparedness side, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done ahead of time, just getting the environment right so you can manage those situations if they do happen to occur. And the thing I think that kind of is a roadblock for a lot of early learning people is it's pretty likely that somebody's going to bite somebody or whack somebody with a toy train, or those kind of things are almost daily events in a lot of early learning settings. And some people in this profession will go through their whole career without having a real fire or having to deal with a real tornado or things like that. So I don't think they take the preparedness as maybe seriously when it comes to training as they do some of the other things maybe. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's accurate. So I would challenge the professionals out there, you know, hey, these are key moments. These are teaching opportunities. We talk about STEM and STREAM and, you know, whatever the new acronym is now.
Yeah.
It seems like we keep adding letters to this thing. But gosh, what a way to teach children. You have a monthly engagement opportunity every single month when we do a fire drill to incorporate some of the STEM, STREAM, STREAMS techniques. To talk about your environment, to get outside, to have, you know, kids understand what the environment looks like and what fire is and how it involves and the interactions that we have. So I would challenge you to, you know, not see this as a nuisance or something that you were mandated to do, but I would challenge you to look at this as a learning opportunity, right? Let's reinforce the drills of teamwork and working together for a common goal. And all these kind of things that we need to be teaching our kids anyway, let's figure out how to build that into our fire drill so it's beyond just an annoyance. It's actually a learning opportunity that we can, you know, leverage every single month.
So, Andrew, if you could, what would be, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, we've got maybe 10, 12 minutes left in this episode, tip suggestions on overall preparedness that you would have for early learning practitioners, just kind of some generalities in the whole preparedness field?
Sure. And I will say, you know, visit our website. We've got a whole host of free resources there. We've even got some documents on what are questions parents should be thinking about and parents should be asking.
And that's childhoodpreparedness.org. And I'll put that in the show notes, listeners, too. So it'll be a click away for you. Cause I'm a helper.
Yeah, cause there's
like
a whole bunch of, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different things, and what we're talking about today is not unique early childhood. I mean, we know from data and surveys that are out there, 35% of parents are not familiar with their child's evacuation and emergency plans, and we know about 41% of parents, they have no idea what location their child would be evacuated to during a disaster and an incident where you had to leave the childhood facility, and that's a big deal. You know, back in Katrina, we had over 5,000 children were separated from their parents. And the last child was finally reunited with their parents after 9 months.
Oh,
think about
oh
that.
Shit. Dang.
Wow.
That does
right.
sound
that's
like
not
a little
something
bit of unpreparedness.
That made the news wow. at all. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. So we, you know, we talk about brain development and all that happens in those first 3 and 5 years of life. I mean, think about going without your parents for 9 months. What kind
yeah.
of impact is that going to have on a
oh,
child?
Oh, man.
Going to be devastating, right? So stuff you can do today to get better prepared. You know, I see it all the time. People will go out and they'll buy stuff. And, you know, and every
yeah, they got the
guilty.
Fire extinguisher in the kitchen, but nobody knows how to use it. But it's here.
Absolutely. Right. And that's a big part of what we do. So we travel the country and we teach, you know, on-site at childhood facilities. And we do active shooter, we do site safety assessments, we do fire extinguisher trainings. And by the way, we do everything in English and Spanish because I do think it's important. Some of these topics can be kind of scary. So I want to make sure we're speaking, you know, in a language that everybody gets and everybody
yeah.
can be comfortable in. But that's a big part of what we do. We go out and actually light some stuff on fire and we actually get people to use a fire extinguisher. And it's amazing to me how many folks have never used one, and how many folks don't know how to use one. And the time to use it, of course, time to learn how to use it is now, and not when the
moment comes. Yeah, in the moment when you're reading the instructions. Hang on, pause the fire for me, please.
And that's great. I love the hands-on aspect of that, because I remember back in my center director days, we would have like somebody from the fire department come over once in a while and do a thing. But I guess they didn't have a real big budget, because he was really reluctant, because it never happened, to kind of pull the trigger on that extinguisher and that kind of stuff. It's kind of like, you would do this and you would pull this and squeeze this. And that's just, it's not really the same experience you have when there's something blazing in front of you and you can feel the heat on your face. So I think it's great that you're out there doing that actual hands-on experiential learning.
Absolutely. And sadly, we've seen, you know, so many disasters and emergencies. We've been working in the Caribbean, and in particular Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, since the hurricanes hit. We've got a few different contracts, one of which is with the federal government to help early childhood respond, recover, and hopefully reopen. And, you know, it's been 2 years. And many places are still closed. I just came back from Puerto Rico yesterday. I'm going to the Virgin Islands tomorrow. So we've got a team of around 15 people that are working on this disaster recovery work. And so I would urge people today, the big thing that we're seeing is a really hard time with insurance. And we have programs right now that after 2 years, they still have not received one dime in insurance money. So if you don't know your insurance provider, if you don't know your coverage limits, if you don't know exactly what's going to be covered and what's not, and how you're going to have to actually produce results and receipts and evidence of what you've lost, and I would encourage you, as we think about, you know, New Year's resolutions, put that at the top of your list and start asking questions about, you know, hey, is this going to cover my staff? Are my staff going to continue to get paid? What about lost revenue? If parents aren't able to afford child care or they physically can't get to my center, am I going to be able to be covered for some of those business losses?
That's a great point. I mean, that's not a sexy preparedness thing, but that's huge. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Jeff, the simple fact of the matter is, after a disaster, about 40% of businesses that have been impacted never reopen.
Never reopen because they didn't do that step.
They didn't do that step, and they don't have the cash reserves on hand. And you know, to be honest, we're not millionaires in early childhood, so we don't exactly have a lot of, you know, reserve funds running around.
Absolutely. That's a great tip.
So to be thinking about those things in advance are really important. Have those discussions again with your insurance carrier. And the other thing we're actually taking a look at right now in Puerto Rico, looking to see what the average length of time for reopening for those programs that were able to reopen is, depending on if you owned your own building, if the building was leased and you rented that building, or if the government owned the building. So it's pretty interesting, depending on if you owned it yourself and privately owned it, if you leased it from somebody, or if the government owned it. There's a pretty big disparity in the length of time it took to get reopened.
Which ones are opening faster?
Well, I've still got some data to do, but right now it seems that the folks that are privately owned, you know, because they're able to control their destiny a little bit more, are able to reopen a lot quicker than the ones that you have to deal with a landlord. And sadly, the ones that are owned by the government, like the Head Starts, the early Head Starts, I mean, think about the Virgin Islands. Right now, they're main hospital is just finally starting to get up and running. I mean, the building was condemned. The health department buildings are condemned. They've had to build temporary structures. We were working out of a tent in the parking lot for the last 2 years.
So
the government has other priorities, you know, reopening hospitals, fire departments, police stations, all these essential services. And, you know, understandably, not everybody can be at the top of that priority list.
Yeah, sure.
So sadly, we see some of the early learning stuff get forgotten about or fall down that list. So
yeah,
I think that stuff is pretty important too.
Absolutely. When it comes to an imaginary 3-year-old teacher in a average early learning setting, when it comes to preparedness, what would your thoughts be on, you know, just overall about something's going down and their mind? I mean, people freak the heck out about things. And so what one or two tips would you have for somebody that is finding themselves in a situation where a child has a bad cut or there's a tornado coming, about getting their head in the right place to deal with the situation? Because I think that's where a lot of people falter, isn't it? They just they become overwhelmed and they panic and they maybe freeze or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really where you see the difference between those who are trained and those who are not trained. I mean, if you're trained, you're going to have muscle memory. You're going to have confidence. You're going to know what to do because you've practiced it. Whereas if you're untrained, you're going to get more into that fight or flight or freeze response, you know, because there is going to be adrenaline. There is going to be cortisol. There's going to be all these drugs that the body produces, all these chemicals flowing through your system. And you can be easily overcome with emotion. You can freeze because you don't know what to do. You're going to be focused on, like, I can't believe this is happening. All that kind of stuff. And I'm a big believer that, you know, in times of crisis, it's our job to share our calm and not to join the chaos of the kids around us.
Yeah, so, yeah, because, you know, I mean, they feed on that. They, I mean, they suck it right up if they're feeling that their caregiver is stressed or frightened or anxious.
Absolutely, and that's a vital part. So, you know, it's interesting. We had a peer-reviewed publication a few months ago. I did a national survey looking at the preparedness levels of early childhood professionals throughout the United States. And, you know, what they reported was 91% said that they were prepared or very prepared for a fire, which, you know, makes sense. What's measured is done, right? So every state requires fire drills. Mm-hmm. 91% said they feel pretty good about fires. But then you see this vast drop off where you get about 79% said that they feel prepared for tornadoes. And then 47% said they feel prepared for floods, and 45% say they feel prepared for an active shooter situation. So that to me is a little bit interesting. You know, every single county in the United States has had a flooding event. As we start to think about weather trends and, you know, we're seeing more downpours. We're not seeing that gentle rain like we used to see. That the you know, oceans are warming up, so we're going to see more hurricanes and more strength of a hurricane. So these flooding events are going to be huge deals. And we're not prepared for that at all, to be honest, at least according to the survey that we did. I mean, not even half of the centers are prepared for it. So we do have a long way to go. I would take this seriously. I would think about, you know, ways that you can look internal to your communities and get some help and resources. Your local emergency manager is a fantastic source of information. And if you haven't connected with that individual, I would strongly encourage you to reach out. They are really interested to know where their vulnerable populations are. And as an early childhood program, you certainly qualify because you know, you're taking care of kids. So I would make those local connections as well.
That's a great suggestion.
I have a question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you.
Is CERT, C-E-R-T, still a thing? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
My dad was super involved in that. And I had forgotten about that till you started talking. I Googled it here really quick to see what popped up. Do you do any work with them? Just for the listeners, it stands for the Community Emergency Response Team.
Yeah, so there's a couple different organizations, and these are usually government run. The CERT teams are usually out of the Emergency Management Department, and then there's a kind of a companion organization called the MRC, the Medical Reserve Corps, which is run out of usually the Public Health Department. And what these two organizations are, they're made up of volunteer community members that are called upon in times of disaster or crisis to help out their community. I'm a very active member of our CERT team here where I live in Washington, D.C. I've done a lot of training with them and helped them with some courses. We had a really cool event in Fairfax, Virginia. Gosh, it's been probably 6-7 months ago. But, you know, we're always looking for ways to get folks engaged. So we had an opportunity, an evening. We brought members of the CERT team and the Medical Reserve Corps team together with the early childhood providers in the community. We bought them some pizza, and we sat there for an evening, and we had all the child care providers bring their emergency response plans, and we paired them up one-on-one so they could get some technical assistance and have a second set of eyes look those plans over and help them revise them. Then we rotated them off to another room where they actually got to build an emergency preparedness kit. So it was this great marriage of community response members, volunteers, and the early childhood sector, you know, getting to know each other better, getting to understand the needs of children in times of disaster, and ultimately, you know, making the community more safe. There's also a couple of Medical Reserve Corps units out there right now that are exploring the issue of how do they stand up a pediatric division of their team that could be deployed in disasters out to emergency shelters. Because you and I know, if you go to these shelters, a lot of times they're in like high school gyms and stuff like that. Well, they're not set up for kids, man. You know, they're not. And there's no cribs. There's no toys. A lot of times there's not even a rug on the floor for the kids to crawl around on. So having a child care provider influence that and maybe even becoming a responder, especially now that we've got this world of background checks and all the stuff that we need to do in early childhood, that can be really powerful as well. So I'm excited by those conversations and that marriage. You know, the action is really in between the sectors, right? So if you can get public health talking to the fire department and emergency management and early childhood, that's where the action is, and that's where we can really make a lot of progress. And that's what really excites me.
That sounds great. About time to wrap this episode up, Andrew. I've got one last cutting question. It cuts to the center of all of this. Comes up all the time. We are big proponents of children being barefoot and shoeless because it affects balance and sensory awareness and everything. And it seems like everybody says we can't be barefoot because fire. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm the kind of jerk that makes you come in and do a fire drill during nap time because I do want to see how you respond and are the shoes on or the shoes off. I've seen it done both ways. I think it's more about the comfort of the kids versus the potential that there may be an emergency. So if you've got your kids shoeless and that's working for you, I don't see a need to change that.
Good, Andrew. I thought the idea that you have to keep your shoes on for the first, 8 years of life because there might be a fire seems a little bit like over-prepared. So I'm glad you got some flexibility there. Hey, listeners, we're going to have Andrew back for another episode where we're going to talk about active shooter drills because we have questions and Andrew has answers. So I think it's good to have that conversation. Andrew, if you, I'm going to put the website out there. It's childhoodpreparedness.org. And they've got a blog and they've got information about booking trainings and that kind of stuff about the things we've been talking about. Andrew, is there any place else on social media or anything like that you'd like to send people?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/childprepared, all one word, or just search for the Institute for Childhood Preparedness. We've got a very active Twitter account and also on Instagram. Hey, we'd love to hear what you're doing. If you've got stories, if you've got questions, if you've got whatever, hit us up. We're always looking to help people. That's what we're in this business for.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Andrew. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. We'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And there's an episode. Thank you, Andrew. That was great.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.